Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. On today's show, a reading of the introduction to Darwin's House of Cards. In this book, veteran journalist Tom Bethel gives us a provocative history of contemporary debates over evolution, with a wide-ranging but concise tour of the flashpoints of modern evolutionary theory, investigating controversies over common descent, natural selection, the fossil record, biogeography, information theory, evolutionary psychology, artificial intelligence, and the growing intelligent design movement. Darwin's House of Cards. Introduction. Doubts about evolution first arose in my mind when I looked at the title page of The Origin of Species. I read, and then reread that page. On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life by Charles Darwin, M.A., 1859. The words preservation and favored stood out. Was there any way of knowing what races, meaning species or individual variants, were favored other than by looking to see which ones were in fact preserved? Can favored be distinguished from preserved? It was in 1960 that my doubts arose. There was a lot of publicity about Darwin's theory at the time, and especially at Oxford University. Exactly 100 years earlier, Thomas Henry Huxley and Bishop Samuel Wilberforce had engaged in a famous debate at the university's Museum of Natural History. Twice a week, en route to tutorials at the psychology department, I would walk past that museum on Parks Road. Psychology, philosophy, and physiology was my major, although we didn't use that word. Psychology aims to study the mind. But the intractable problem was, and remains, that you can't see the mind from the outside. You can only experience it from within, and that means you can't touch it or measure it. As they said at the time, the mind is a black box. By the mid-20th century, psychology was worshipping at the feet of science, and observing and measuring are fundamental aspects of science. So an obvious question arose: could science penetrate the black box of the mind? In an attempt to circumvent it, a discipline called behavioralism had been established by John B. Watson. He in turn was influenced by Ivan Pavlov. The goal was to reduce psychology to behavior, thereby sidestepping the black box problem. Responses, outputs, would be compared to stimuli, inputs. As long as a predictable relationship could be established between the two, the mind and consciousness could be quietly ignored, and even, as far as science was concerned, assumed not to exist. Thought was assumed to be covert speech. Both behaviorism and neo-Darwinism derived their inspiration from the same zeitgeist of reductionist philosophy which prevailed during the first half of our 20th century, writes Arthur Koestler. He characterized the conventional wisdom of that time as the belief that biological evolution was nothing but random mutations, preserved by natural selection. It remains the conventional wisdom to this day. Experimental psychology could also study the brain directly, assuming it to be the mind's location. So researchers began dipping into the brain with electrodes. Today, that field is called neuroscience. Meanwhile, the mind remains as intangible as ever. A part of the brain lighting up is one thing, and the individual sensation of blue is another. In fact, they are incommensurable things. Survival of the fittest. As to natural selection's preservation of the favored races, Herbert Spencer, a prominent figure in his day, said that Darwin's mechanism could be summarized as the survival of the fittest. Darwin was not impressed by Spencer, but he gratefully accepted his survival of the fittest formula and incorporated it into the fifth edition of The Origin of Species. So the question remains, is there any way of deciding what is fit other than by seeing what survives? If not, maybe Darwin was arguing in a self-confirming circle, the survival of the survivors. One day I mentioned the problem to my philosophy tutor, E.J. Lemon, who had studied under Alfred Tarski. Esteemed for his clarity, Dr. Lemon gave weekly lectures in the school's building on Oxford's High Street. The vast hall would be packed with undergraduates hoping to get through their logic prelims. Lemon saw that the meaning of fitness was something that the leading field of Oxford philosophy, the Ordinary Language School, dominated by John L. Austin, might find interesting. Can we describe the fitness of an organism, or one of its traits, without waiting to see what survives and what doesn't? It was not a question that Dr. Lemon had been thinking about, but he allowed that it was worth considering. A few years later, he was hired away by Claremont Graduate School in California. Despite a weak heart, he climbed a hillside and was felled by a heart attack right there. He can't have been more than 40 years old. An austere volume, Beginning Logic, has survived him. When I look at its bleak truth tables, I feel that it doesn't do justice to the man. I had arrived at Oxford naively imagining that philosophy taught us the meaning of life. I went to public lectures by Gilbert Ryle, whose book The Concept of Mind was then in fashion. It was plainly written, but like the psychologists of the day, Ryle aimed to reduce mind to behavior. I even attended a seminar by A.J. Iyer until I realized that I didn't understand half of what was said, not least by his voluble graduate students. In 1936, at the age of 26, Freddie Iyer had written Language, Truth, and Logic, declaring most philosophical problems to be meaningless, especially the ones that undergraduates were likely to find interesting. Late in life, he died in 1989, Iyer had a near-death experience. A resolute non-believer, he nonetheless wrote an article titled What I Saw When I Was Dead. He told his attending physician, "I saw a divine being. I'm afraid I'm going to have to revise all my books and opinions." Later, he said the experience had weakened not my belief that there is no life after death, but my inflexible attitude towards that belief. Oxford philosophy was in some ways, intentionally, disillusioning, but later I came to see its usefulness. Many problems in philosophy had flourished over the years because the words formulating them often had no clear meaning. Philosophers had sometimes even indulged that imprecision. Fitness, at any rate, seemed worth analyzing, especially if its vagueness had misled biologists into believing that a mechanism of evolution had been discovered. Maybe they had only discovered that saying the same thing in two different ways could be so construed. The 1860 encounter between Huxley and Bishop Wilberforce was seen as a debate between religion and science. It was the first time, but far from the last, that Darwinism would generate such a conflict. Over the next 150 years, science and religion were routinely portrayed as antagonists, as they still are today. But it's a modern conceit. A counterclaim was persuasively made by Cambridge University's James Hannam in The Genesis of Science. Medieval Christianity actually laid the groundwork for the blossoming of science, Hannam argues. Newton, Faraday, and Clerk Maxwell, to name just three, embraced religion even as they advanced science. Nonetheless, the religion versus science stereotype did arise after Darwin's The Origin of Species, and in consequence of it. In 1925, it was reinforced in America when John Scopes was indicted for teaching evolution in defiance of a Tennessee statute. The trial was a media circus, perhaps one of the first. Clarence Darrow derided William Jennings Bryan's fundamentalism, and scientific questions about Darwinism hardly arose. Ridicule carried the day. To this day, those who question Darwinism are sometimes still suspected of hostility to reason. At any rate, the validity of evolution as science is the key question to be addressed in this book. I hope to do so with minimal regard to religion. Stephen Jay Gould once wrote that the magisteria of science and religion don't overlap. Nonetheless, keeping them separate has never been easy. The main reason is that Darwin's supporters are eager to blur the distinction. Often they resemble inquisitors, hunting for a heretical motive whenever criticism of evolution is raised. Darwin himself frequently argued his case in The Origin of Species by favourably contrasting his theory of descent with modification with the old story of independent creation. The former obviously was more plausible to him. Nonetheless, we plainly see evidence of design in complex self-reproducing organisms. But Darwin and his modern disciples have insisted that this is a delusion. I question whether it really is, and discuss the intelligent design movement in a later chapter. In his correspondence, often less inhibited than his books, Darwin was disposed to give theological reasons for rejecting the evidence of design. "There seems to me too much misery in the world," he wrote to Asa Gray in 1860. "I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the Ichneumonidae, digger wasps, with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars, or that a cat should play with mice." After I graduated from Oxford, the evolution question faded from my mind. It wasn't revived until 10 years later. Then, in America, I came across a surprising book, Darwin Retried. Its author, Norman Macbeth, was a Harvard-trained lawyer. We may think of him as the forerunner to Philip Johnson, the law professor at UC Berkeley who did so much to launch the intelligent design movement. Macbeth's book carried impressive endorsements by Jacques Barzun, Arthur Koestler, and Karl Popper. "I regard the book as most meritorious and as a really important contribution to the debate," Popper wrote. A philosopher who was taken seriously at Oxford, Popper argued that to be certified as scientific, theories must in principle be falsifiable. It must be possible to devise experiments that can put such theories to the test, maybe corroborating them, or, more critically, showing them to be false. Was that possible with Darwin's theory? Popper's criterion has since been challenged, but his principle of falsification is sound. True, a theory that is sufficiently hedged and qualified can be protected against all opposition, but hedged theories make for poor science, and when the Popperian test is weakened, so are the claims of hedged theories. Macbeth's book cited such pillars of Darwinian orthodoxy as Ernst Mayr, George Gaylord Simpson, and Sir Julian Huxley, grandson of T.H. I was delighted to see that one of the authorities cited by Macbeth, Conrad Waddington of Edinburgh University, confirmed my earlier doubts. A developmental biologist and a member of the small group of evolutionists who had shaped what became known as the Neo-Darwinian synthesis, Waddington said in 1959, "Darwin's major contribution was the suggestion that evolution can be explained by the natural selection of random variations. Natural selection, which was at first considered as though it were a hypothesis that was in need of experimental or observational confirmation, turned out on closer inspection to be a tautology, a statement of an inevitable, although previously unrecognized, relation. It states that the fittest individuals in a population, defined as those that leave most offspring, will leave most offspring. Once the statement is made, its truth is apparent." Norman Macbeth and I soon became friends, and we discussed this and many other things. He lived near Manhattan, and he introduced me to biologists and curators at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. I would learn that they had much more to say on related topics. I also had lengthy discussions with Colin Patterson, Gary Nelson, an expert on fossil fishes, and Norman Platnick, an expert on spiders. In his autobiography, Karl Popper said he had come to the conclusion that Darwinism is not a testable scientific theory, but a metaphysical research program. To say that a species now living is adapted to its environment is almost tautological, he wrote. Adaptation or fitness is defined by modern evolutionists as survival value, and can be measured by actual success in survival. There is hardly any possibility of testing a theory as feeble as this. Further controversy ensued, for Popper, apparently under pressure in England, partially recanted in 1978. Later, in 1988, I had a chance to interview Popper myself when he spent a week at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. I immediately brought up the issue of natural selection. He told me that his opinion had not changed. He also said he thought that natural selection had in fact been falsified by Darwin's own theory. Distortions introduced by sexual selection sometimes meant that offspring were not better adapted than their parents, he said. When I mentioned that Darwinism had evidently benefited from the idea of progress, widely accepted in the mid-19th century but widely rejected in the late 20th, Popper said that I have been one of the people who have destroyed it. He said he had preached along those lines in his book The Poverty of Historicism. Popper's comment that Darwin's theory is feeble is certainly true, and Darwinism can also be viewed as a research program. But it's not clear that natural selection can ever be falsified in any particular context. See my chapter 5. Suffice it to say that evolutionists cling to natural selection, and have done so tenaciously ever since Darwin. It is the main mechanism of biological improvement, or progression from molecules to man, that has been attributed to the undirected or random operations of the natural world. Both Popper and Koestler suggest that Darwinism was a child of its time, inspired more by the zeitgeist than by science strictly construed. What about today? In his posthumously published book, The Discarded Image, C.S. Lewis argued that the scientific facts that seem important in one age may be seen quite differently in another, or may be ignored altogether. The question whether our time is significantly different from Darwin's is an important one, and I discuss it in my first chapter. That's the introduction to Darwin's House of Cards. Enjoy the rest of Tom Bethel's story by grabbing a copy of the book. It's available now in digital and physical formats at popular online and offline book retailers. For more information, visit www.discoveryinstitutepress.com. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.